Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Talk radio across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning, welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, right here on Talk Radio, the world headquarters of common sense. You knew that, though, of course, didn't you? We awake this morning to the news that there is a perfect storm apparently brewing, rising energy prices, trade crises, and pressure on everybody's cost of living. But there are, as always, plenty of bright spots as well. Priti Patel is vowing to lock up the Moosley Knitting M25 Brigade to stop them from holding up the traffic whenever they like in the name of insulating Britain. The Home Secretary was obviously listening to the show yesterday and picked up a couple of tips from yours truly, and of course, many of you who called in to say that these people should be completely and utterly outlawed so that they can never hold up the traffic again. Boris Johnson is still over in America. He's got some things to do there before he comes back later on this week. He's got a spring in his step, though, after opening up the travel corridor. And he's now probably firmly of the opinion that Joe Biden isn't particularly keen on proving himself to be a great ally of the United Kingdom. And I think it's better to know that now. He was making all sorts of noises about how the trade deal was going to be difficult, how we should not be interfering in the Good Friday Agreement in order to get Brexit done in Northern Ireland. And I think Joe Biden, quite frankly, is not somebody that we can rely on to always be on our side. The other piece of unadulterated good news for me is that the French are still fuming. Emmanuel Macron has been stewing in a temper ever since Australia decided to ditch its submarine contract last week. Now he's threatening to give up his seat at the UN Security Council and hand it to the European Union in the hopes of forming an EU army. What's that you say? That was just a myth that was dreamt up by Brexiteers? An EU army, you say? Sacre bleu. Whatever next, we'll be seeking the help of former Brexit Party MEP and businessman Ben Habib, who will have plenty to say about Biden's attitude towards the UK when it comes to trade, and also the Northern Ireland Protocol as well. 0344 499 1000. Coming up, we've got the latest from the front line of the energy crisis, and we want to offer you some help as well. If you've got questions about your energy bill and what to do if your supplier has either gone bust or is ramping up the prices madly, we want you to send them to us, and we will get them answered with a consumer champion, Jasmine Birtles, later on in the show. Tonya Buxton is here as well with her take on the vaccination rollout in our schools. Like me, she is not supporting the government policy of getting our children jabbed to safeguard other people, particularly adults who have already been vaccinated. Plus, it's PMQs today, even though the Prime Minister's away, so we can look forward to Dominic Raab taking to the dispatch box against the very colourful Angela Rayner, who is almost certainly going to be a whole lot more entertaining than the usual Sir Keir Starmer bore fest. We'll be having Peter Cardwell in to get his view on all of that. We'll also be finding out what on earth is going on at the BBC. Strictly is back, but it could be going again after just one performance thanks to an outbreak of COVID and a row over some dancers who refused to get the vaccine. Very strange business indeed. You're listening to me right here on the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, there's lots of headlines about trade deals in the papers this morning. President sinks hopes of quick trade deal with the US. I'm always rather suspicious of politicians who start saying things are going to be difficult, because almost certainly it's an argument that they are making. It's a negotiating position. They're basically going to try and get something before they give something. And Joe Biden, I thought yesterday, overall, was pretty rude. We've actually got a clip of Boris Johnson speaking when he was addressing one of the questions that was asked about him. We're going to play it a little bit later on. But right in the middle of his actual sort of monologue, if you like, his explanation of what was going on with the Good Friday Agreement, suddenly the White House press corps are ordered out of the room. And there's this massive sort of melee as people get up and start walking away. Now, this is a British Prime Minister. You might be the President of the United States of America, but there's absolutely no point in pretending that you're more important than the British Prime Minister, particularly if you are more important. Important people tend not to be pompous. So I think Joe Biden let himself down. Let's get the view of Ben Habib, CEO of First Property Group and former Brexit Party MEP. Ben, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
I don't know whether I'm right in taking this view of Joe Biden, but he seemed to me to be a little bit kind of mealy-mouthed and slightly petty yesterday, didn't he?
Well, I think there's general antipathy towards the United Kingdom is the impression I get from Joe Biden. Mm. You know, he treated us terribly and he continues to treat us terribly over the Northern Ireland Protocol, refuses to understand the sensitivity of the subject and the importance of the East-West dimension as well as the North-South dimension. And of course, he treated us shoddily over Afghanistan. You know, he gave us scant warning of his overnight withdrawal. I think he gave us no warning of his overnight withdrawal of troops, left us, you know, stranded high and dry. And here we have him walking out with his press, entourage, leaving Boris Johnson slightly embarrassed.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, talk of no trade deal, which was kind of a hint after the Northern Ireland Protocol conversation, as if the two things are linked. What did you make of that?
Well, you know, I think the whole thing about a US-UK trade deal is overblown. I'm not sure that we even need or want one. You know, if we're going to trade, we already have a very successful trading relationship with the US. But if we want to expand that, I think we're much better off approaching mayors and governors of local states and doing sort of bilateral deals with individual states, as it were, than with the United States as a federal organization. You know, you've got to remember that each one of the states in the US is almost the size of a country, if not bigger than many, many countries. So, you know, they're worth spending time on and getting right. So I think this whole thing about a US-UK trade deal is an unnecessary, overly sort of blown up, important subject.
Yes, I think so. Because often when I speak to businessmen, and even businessmen like yourself, Ben, you know, trade is done between businesses. It's not really done between countries, unless you're talking about something like the submarine deal that the US and the UK are doing with Australia. You know, by and large, you're exporting your goods to somebody else in a place where other people are going to buy them. You don't really need the government at all, do you?
Absolutely right. And this whole idea that tariff-free and frictionless trade is somehow better for business is slightly wrong. You know, if you've got a product that people want to buy, people will buy it. The cost of tariffs and the slight difficulty associated with filling in paperwork won't prohibit your customer base from buying your product. The really key thing the United Kingdom needs to do is to produce stuff that people want to buy and then sell it.
Well, exactly right. And what did you make of what was said about the Northern Ireland business? Because Nancy Pelosi was over here earlier on this week, I think, or towards the end of last week, talking about how Northern Ireland was a place which we shouldn't be messing with, which I thought was rather presumptuous of her, but sort of signifying basically the Biden administration's idea that somehow the UK mustn't meddle in the Northern Ireland Protocol over Brexit, or else there would be a problem from the White House.
Yeah. And, you know, we've had this from the US for decades that they've supported really the Republican position over the Unionist position. And they're doing it in spades against actually a deal that the US was instrumental in brokering back in 1998. You know, the Good Friday Agreement, Joe Biden seems to have forgotten and Nancy Pelosi seemed to have forgotten, requires an East-West dimension as importantly as it requires a North-South dimension. And what the protocol does is utterly break the East-West connection, the connection between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. And it does so without the consent of the people of Northern Ireland, another crucial component of the Good Friday Agreement. So, you know, this idea that we can't have a border on the island of Ireland is a fundamentally flawed one. In fact, the Good Friday Agreement specifically accepts and acknowledges that border. And there's nothing in it that prohibits customs checks taking place at the border. So it's a very misunderstood subject, which the EU and Ireland have championed in the US and taken control of the propaganda, if you like. And the UK has been left far behind, looking like the bad boys. But in fact, it is the protocol that is wrong, and it is the protocol that breaches the Good Friday Agreement.
And you've got something going on shortly, haven't you? Because you've got this lawsuit which has been rattling around in Northern Ireland for a while. What's the latest on that?
Well, we lost, as we anticipated we would, the court case, the High Court case back in on the 30th of June. But we have appealed that, and that's going to the Court of Appeal in Northern Ireland on the 11th and 12th of October. And I was just reading the arguments that we're going to be making in the appeals court. And I have to say, every time I read those arguments, I just cannot see, as a plain, common sense layman on the Clapham omnibus, how any judge could find us to be wanting in our case. Mm. The fact is that that protocol breaches not just the Good Friday Agreement, as we've just discussed, it breaches the very Act of Union of the United Kingdom, a fundamentally important constitutional act. And indeed, Mike, as you might recall, the judge, even though he dismissed our case in the High Court, he acknowledged that the Act of Union lay asunder as a result of the protocol, which was a very interesting conclusion for the judge to reach. He didn't find it illegal. He didn't find the protocol illegal, but he did acknowledge and accept that it drove a coach and horses through our Act of Union.
Mm. And so where does that leave your case? I mean, are you able to take it on in any way?
Well, we have appealed it. It's going to the appeals court on the 11th and 12th of October. And I think as we go through the appeals process, our arguments will be much better revealed. And I'm hopeful that once we get to the Supreme Court, that actually we will prevail. We might prevail on the 11th and 12th of October. But I'm hopeful, certainly when we get to the Supreme Court, that British justice will be blind to political persuasion and that we will get the right judgment.
Absolutely right. And what are you making as well at the moment of the other? We were told there's massive sort of crises looming. The papers love the idea of a crisis, and they're talking about a trade deal problem. They're talking about an energy crisis, which we might say we are kind of already in, aren't we?
We are. I mean, we're walking into, we've got an energy crisis, and we're walking into a much bigger one with this self-imposed green industrial revolution. You know, it's not as if the United Kingdom has a whole host of nuclear power stations that can kick in and produce environmentally friendly electricity. You know, we've seen the disruption, which are actually not a very significant increase in gas prices can make to our economy. And we're going to go on ratcheting up that pain as we head towards this net zero by 2050 with various, you know, marker stones on the way. I think this whole net zero green industrial revolution needs to be thought through again before we go further with it.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that we wouldn't be in this position if we hadn't had this headlong kind of rush into wind power and sea power and all of these renewable energy sources, when we've actually clearly got quite a big stock of coal under the ground. We've got quite a big stock of shale gas as well. Surely that would be the way forward, wouldn't it?
Well, I mean, coal is undoubtedly a dirty fuel. But why we haven't been building mini nuclear power stations across the country? You know, if we want to produce an abundance of electricity for electric cars, which, by the way, would really burden our power generating capability as it stands at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine if everybody had an electric car now?
I know. I mean, our grid would just come to a rapid halt. Yeah. And you can't rely on these wind farms because the wind may not blow. And, you know, so you need a reliable source of continuous energy. And I think the way forward would have been these mini nuclear power stations, but they don't form part of the Prime Minister's plans.
No. I mean, it is kind of ironic that in the midst of all of this, he's over in America trying to get some kind of commitment to cut carbon even more, you know, when he should really be back here, should he not, making sure that there's enough supplies of CO2, which I'm told we might now have to buy in from America, and there's enough gas coming over from Russia.
Yeah, and, you know, it's absurd, really, that we are in this position, created largely of our own making. There's no need for it. We could have been much more relaxed with our approach to it all. You know, the United Kingdom produces 0.1% of greenhouse gas emissions globally. We're one of the good guys. We don't need to be beating ourselves up over it. It's China. It's the US. These are the countries that are producing greenhouse gases. It's not the UK. Assuming you buy into the whole greenhouse gas climate sort of extinction rebellion case. You know,
not
it's not
really
us that's the problem. No, exactly. Not really.
No, thanks. Well, I mean, the idea that these maniacs are running around the M25 every day complaining that they haven't got their homes insulated. I mean, it's like I said yesterday, you might as well ask for the letter M to be stricken from the English language. I mean, it's just a pointless activity, isn't it?
It's outrageous. The cost of retrofitting all the houses to make them compliant with this ridiculously unnecessary high standard is something like £5 billion. Mm. That's the entire corporation tax increase that Rishi Sunak has imposed on the private sector, which, as we know, has already been kicked in the shins. So why would anyone wish to spend £5 billion retrofitting houses that don't need to be retrofitted? The problem isn't the United Kingdom. The problem is China. The problem is the United States of America, if it is greenhouse gases that you want to target.
It really is extraordinary, isn't it? And I see that Priti Patel is asking for extra powers and trying to get injunctions and things. I hope she's more successful against these people than she has been against the dinghy arrivers.
Yeah, well, we'll wait and see. Priti Patel has been, you know, like all our cabinet ministers, very long on rhetoric, pretty short on delivery. And, you know, I really hope that the Prime Minister thinks through this green industrial revolution, because it doesn't sit at all comfortably with his promise to level up the country. The only way he's going to finance all these wind farms and, you know, tidal wave power generating equipment and so on, or the only way he's going to do it is by raising taxes across the board. And that is going to disproportionately hit the working classes and the middle class is harder than anyone else.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is not a levelling up agenda. That is a sort of, it's a sort of Islington elitist intellectual agenda.
Yeah.
It's where, you know, it's where all these ideas are thought up.
Yes. Well, it's all these people that have big gardens and big garages so that they can put these new heating systems into their homes. But a lot of people don't have gardens or indeed garages or indeed anything other than a one or two bedroom flat, which you can't fit in all this stuff.
And they certainly can't afford a brand new electric car, which, by the way, I'm told, doesn't have a resales value. These things last about 7 or 8 years, I'm told, and then you can't resell them because the battery's gone, which is the, you know, significant part of the expenditure. Mm. You know, where are you going to get 20 grand? If you're used to driving a 2 grand beaten up car, where are you going to get 20 grand to upgrade to this wonderful utopian vision of carbon neutrality?
Yes.
It's just for the birds.
It really is. And it is. I was talking to somebody earlier on about the business of the oil companies and the way that the rest of the world operates. And there are plenty of poor countries in parts of Africa, in parts of Asia, where, you know, this is not even a conversation because they can't afford to go green because they simply haven't got enough money.
No, it's not. It's just not part of the conversation. And the other thing I want to touch on, Mike, while we're discussing it, you know, one of the biggest problems with the British economy is that everything is very expensive.
Yeah.
We are now a very high tax, highly regulated economy. If you go to the States, the cost of living is a fraction of what it is in the UK. Mm. If you go to Europe, it's a fraction of what it is in the UK. And certainly if you go to parts of Africa, Southeast Asia, Far East, it's a fraction of the cost of the UK. The Prime Minister should be finding ways to cut taxes, cut regulations, reduce friction on business, reduce the tax burden, and make us a more cost-effective, dynamic economy. And the green industrial revolution is not the way to go about it.
No, because all that's doing is pushing prices up even further. Ben, stay where you are, because I want to talk to you about France as well before we go any further. We're talking to Ben Habib, CEO of First Property Group, former Brexit Party MEP, of course, as well. The EU army is back, apparently. We're going to talk to Ben about that next here on Talk Radio.
This is Talk Radio across the UK, online, on DAB Plus, and on the Talk Radio app. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. We've got lots going on. Tony Buxton's going to be here in a little while. We've got Prime Minister's questions today, which actually might be quite interesting, simply because Angela Rayner's doing it for the Labour Party instead of Keir Starmer. So it'll be far more entertaining, I'm sure. We're talking to Ben Habib, CEO of First Property Group, former Brexit Party MEP. Let's just have a look at that video I was talking about earlier. Boris Johnson in the White House with Joe Biden. And a rather extraordinary way to treat the British Prime Minister.
Interrupts or unbalances the Belfast Good Friday Accords. That's the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. That's the.
Thank you.
Now, if you're not able to watch that, that was basically Boris Johnson and Joe Biden sitting in a room together on chairs, wearing masks, Boris talking about the Good Friday Agreement and the Northern Ireland Protocol. Suddenly, in the middle of it, the White House staff ordered all the press out of the room. So right in the middle of his statement, they all just got up and walked out. Very bizarre way to treat the British Prime Minister, Ben, isn't it?
Well, I've been very suspect of this special relationship. If we had a special relationship, we wouldn't have had the fiasco that we had in Afghanistan. And whilst I wholeheartedly support this new AUKUS deal between ourselves, Australia, and the US, I do hope that we've built into it some pretty cast iron promises from the United States that we will be properly consulted as a party to that agreement before unilateral decisions are made. Mm. You know, it seems to me that this special relationship favors the UK only when the US wants it to favor the UK. Most of the time, we're sort of the US's lapdog. And, you know, one of the things about Brexit, without wishing to, you know, veer away from the subject, one of the things about Brexit was that it was to enable the United Kingdom to go forth and do what's right for the United Kingdom. And we've got to stop, I think, acting through these supranational global institutions in partnership repeatedly with other countries over which we have very little influence. We need to start doing things much more unilaterally, much more British interests first, prosecuting what's right for this country. So whilst I support AUKUS, you know, I do hope it has protections in it. And I think the Prime Minister sitting in that room with Joe Biden needed to have been very forthright and firm that actually we will do with Northern Ireland what is right for the United Kingdom,
yeah,
not what the Americans think might be right.
No, exactly right. And what about this latest gambit from Emmanuel Macron? I'm quite enjoying the fact that he's fuming, by the way, because
I love it.
It shows just how petty the French can be by pulling out ambassadors from America and Australia, but not Britain, because he hates Britain that much. He's now talking about giving up his seat at the UN Security Council in order for the EU to have a seat and for them to promote the EU army idea again.
Yeah. Well, I love the fact that he's so upset about AUKUS. You know, this is a country that has snubbed the Anglosphere's foreign policy for the last 20 years. Not that I'm a supporter of the Iraq war, but France voted against it. France has sidled up to Iran repeatedly when we've had to bring Iran to heel. France has supported China when we've all been trying to bring China to heel. And here we have, at last, a relationship between the Anglosphere, if you like, in AUKUS, between the US, UK and Australia. And France is so upset about it. And the other thing to bear in mind about France is that actually it's never met its NATO targets. It's never met 2% of its GDP on defence spending. So it's got absolutely no right now to be jabbing a finger at the United Kingdom, US and Australia, claiming it's been left out of this club. It has no legitimate right at the table. It hasn't been an ally in any sense for the last 20 years when it comes to foreign policy.
No.
And by the way, that largely applies to the EU as well.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I think the true colours are now being shown. Ben, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Ben Habib there, CEO of First Property Group and former Brexit Party MEP, reporting into us there from Karachi in Pakistan.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Now, we were talking earlier about the energy crisis. We've got all sorts of stories around this morning about what is going on in the big wide world out there, how people are being affected, particularly by a shortage of CO2. Let's talk now to Nick Allen, Chief Executive of the British Meat Processors Association. Nick, a very good morning to you.
Yeah, good morning.
I think an awful lot of people until this week, Nick, had no clue that CO2 was such an important conglomerate part of all sorts of things. Tell us what you do with it.
I know. Well, you know, certainly in the meat sector, as you highlighted, it's used for the humane slaughter of pigs and sort of poultry, and it's mainly used for the extension of shelf life, sort of even more widely, and that goes into the food sector as well. It's used in the freezing of meat as well. You know, so yeah, and when you look into actually CO2, it's amazing. It's a real farm to fork product, you know, right down to the beer in your pub.
Yes.
And the sort of
right
beers.
And given that is the case, Nick, are you surprised that we've sort of come to this point so quickly, that we've run out or appear to be almost about to run out of it with a very short period of time?
Well, we had a close shave back in 2018, so this didn't really come as a surprise. So it's been on our watch list for a little while, but unfortunately, this is what's happening with the world. You know, we're ending up with more and more consolidated sort of supply chains, and everything is in the hands of fewer and fewer people. I mean, what we were surprised about was that this plant could close, knowing its importance, and it must have known its importance on the sort of in terms of supplying CO2 to the whole industry, that it could almost sort of close at the drop of a hat, and that took us by surprise.
Yes, quite. And so, why has that happened? Why is it now in the hands of fewer and fewer people?
Well, it's happening all the time in the world, really. Just about every week, you know, there's a takeover of another sort of company on an international basis. And I think all these things go through under the radar and people don't really notice it. But, you know, there will be other incidents where we'll discover that all of a sudden, you know, the control of something has got in the hands of just a very few people. Just another example, actually, I don't think people realise that increasingly the number of containers in the world that move product around the world are getting in fewer and fewer hands, you know, and all of a sudden you're going to be sort of vulnerable to these massive international companies if we're not so careful. So it needs looking at on an international basis. It's not something one individual country can do.
No, but is it a factor that's affecting this country more than others?
I think that probably just at this moment in time, as we've stepped out of Europe and not had that safety net of being part of a bigger, bigger market, and we've yet to actually sort of find, you know, we've heard today in the news, you know, we might be joining a North American sort of trade deal pact. We're trying to join. Just at this moment in time, we're probably a little bit more vulnerable because we're out there on our own and actually haven't really sealed these deals and these pacts with other countries yet. So we're probably a little bit more vulnerable than we have been for. Some time, yeah.
So in a way, this could be put down to just sorting some things out post-Brexit then.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a lot of things that we've got to sort of sort out post-Brexit. I mean, you don't just pull the plug on 40 years of being part of a big market overnight. It's going to take the country time to sort all these things out, really, and things that keep coming out of the woodwork that need to be sort of sorted out.
Yeah. So what is the plan, as far as you're aware of it, Nick, from this point on? I mean, I've read stories about how we might be having to buy subsidised CO2 from American companies, or we might even be getting the government to sort of fork out quite a lot of money in order to make sure that your sort of clients, if you like, and your customers are able to operate.
Yeah, I mean, what's happened, we were reaching a really critical point, you know, from the slaughter of animals, in particular on pigs and poultry. Some of our members only had sort of 4 days left. So this has come through in the nick of sort of time. So it's quite right that the government, and they were almost the only people that could step in here and actually offer a bit of a safety net to keep this company open while everyone negotiates with them a different pricing structure for CO2. And that's what's going to be happening over the next 3 weeks. Mm. Government's only stepped in here for 3 weeks. You know, to actually sort of help everyone sort of change over. So in the next 3 weeks, we've got to have a complete restructuring of the CO2 pricing in right through the industry, and not just in the food industry. This is going to impact on the nuclear industry, on the hospitals, right the way through. It's a widely used product. So as you say, we've got a 3 week window to sort this out.
Okay. And as far as people's kind of, I don't know, food on their plates is concerned, you know, from the point of view of just the regular consumer, are they likely to be facing any kind of shortages or anything?
Well, the immediate crisis has been averted. We really could see within the next 2 or 3 weeks, actually, that pork and poultry would have been under a serious threat, and never mind the animal, you know, the white shells, the animal welfare consequences back on farm could have been serious. So that, for the moment, has been averted. We've got an ongoing problem, which is to do with labour shortages in the food industry, you know, so then. That's not just in the meat sector, it's right the way through. I joined a meeting yesterday about a wider industry discussion, and some people were talking about how there's empty greenhouses in the country because they haven't got the labour to grow products in these houses. Just the meat sector's got this problem.
And is that an issue of wages, or is that an issue of just people not wanting to do those types of jobs? Because I hear different stories, you know, that, you know, I was watching, I think, a pig farmer. We had him on our show, and he was telling us that, you know, he was going to have to slaughter a load of pigs because they literally didn't have enough people to butcher them and kill them for food. And because if they live too long, they're not really any use to anybody. So, I mean, is it about paying people more money, or is it about finding people who want to do those jobs?
It's both, actually. It's finding people that want to do those jobs. We are paying them more. I mean, a lot the pay has gone up considerably. Everyone's fighting for labour out there. There's a million sort of jobs out there, so everyone's paying them more. It is about getting people that want to do those jobs, and also it's getting them in the right places. A lot of our plants, in particular, are situated more in the countryside, where it's easy to get animals to. So it's not that easy to get some people to. And that what's evolved over the last, you know, 40 years is actually we have been dependent on migrant workers, people from the EU in particular, and they would come here and they stay for, you know, 3 years or so. They would actually live 4 or 5 in a house or something like that. If you want one British worker to, you know, sort of to move to that area, you know, that's that whole house occupied, you know. So the mobility of labour is a sort of problem as well.
Absolutely right. And I'm told that there was a closure of a fertiliser factory up in the northeast of England, which supplied an awful lot of CO2 to the country. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a byproduct of fertilizer. Yeah. So that is what this is about, is having to step in and keep these fertilizer plants running, because they said it wasn't economic to produce fertilizer here. Mm. We're stopping producing the fertilizer, and before we knew it, we had no CO2 because it's a byproduct.
Yeah, extraordinary, really, that one closure could cause all this, really, isn't it?
Well, it is it. I mean, these two plants really, you know, produce something like, we discover that, you know, produce sort of 60% of the CO2 in the UK. So, it's we sort of knew it. But as I said earlier, what came as a shock to us is how quickly this plant closed down. There was no forewarning about it. Right. That came as a real shock to us.
Okay. Well, Nick, appreciate your time. Thank you very much indeed. Nick Allen, Chief Executive of the British Meat Processors Association. They're summing up what is not so much now of a crucial problem as it was. They seem to have sorted out the short-term scenario, so you won't be going without food, you probably won't be going without pigs in blankets, you probably won't be going without turkey at Christmas, you know. So once again, there has been quite a lot of scaremongering going on, because that's what newspapers like to do, some newspapers, that is. They love to tell you how terrible it all is. Daily Mirror this morning has got a front page saying a perfect storm. And they're basically talking about how terrible everything is going to be. They say the cost of living crisis is going to hit Britain for 2 years. Inflation to increase as energy and fuel bills rise. Benefits cut. Taxes up. Furlough schemes ending.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
And here's Tonya Buxton. A very good morning to you, Tonya.
Good morning, Mike.
Welcome. It's a beautiful day.
It is a lovely day.
I, unlike a lot of people in this world, am not a pessimist. And I don't like being told constantly that we're in some kind of trouble and that we're all in terrible, terrible places. And, you know, when you get things like the Daily Mirror saying a perfect storm.
It's the fear narrative.
Yeah, it's the way stop trying to frighten people.
They've learned to control us through fear.
Yeah.
The anxiety of the nation is through the roof. I actually saw someone the other day who was telling me, this girl was 25, and I was inquiring about her sister who's 22, and she goes, oh, my sister won't go out anywhere. She won't travel. She hasn't travelled.
Really?
She has such serious COVID anxiety. She's so worried about it.
That's awful, isn't it?
A 22-year-old.
Isn't that dreadful?
And so this is what the government does. Well, now it's doing it through whether we can pay for our heating or not, or whether we're going to have electricity or whatever it is. The fear narrative is very, very clever because it does control people. Because as Zoe Clues said, who was on here, we are pre-programmed to go for safety rather than happiness.
Right.
So by pushing people through fear, they're getting their way. But what is the quality of life and what is the quality of the nation? Mm. Nobody seems to care about that.
But luckily, there are enough of us, I think, who can work our way through that. And, and whenever I'm out and about, I mean, London is really busy now, which I'm really pleased to
I
see.
Love it.
I love the fact that at night time, there's loads of people walking around. London Bridge area is massively busy. I know not every place is busy, but there's definitely fewer and fewer people doing what you've just described and staying home and not wanting to come out.
No, we've got to kind of change the mindset. But in changing the mindset, oh, Mike, I'm going to try not to screech.
Okay.
But this thing with children's vaccinations is really, it's causing me completely sleepless nights. Mm. I don't understand it. And one of the things that really kind of drives me nuts is that a report that came out today, but let me go backwards first. So when MP Miriam Cates had the debate yesterday about children's vaccines, do you know that Sajid Javid, our health secretary, who's supposed to give a damn about our health and our children's health, the future of the nation's health, he didn't turn up.
Really?
No.
That's shocking.
That's disgusting. Yeah. It's vile and he should be out of a job. Mm. We are talking about the health of the future and he can't be bothered to turn up in the debate.
What was so important that kept him away?
I can't imagine anything more important than that. And then we wake up this morning to the news about Isabella Borges Valentim, who is a young 16-year-old who had the Pfizer vaccine on August the 25th and it then died through complications with blood clots. Mm. And they have come to the conclusion that it was the vaccine that caused her death.
Right.
Brazil's Ministry of Health, they are requesting the vaccine be suspended.
Yeah.
Just like Beverly Turner is at this moment in time in court trying to get it suspended. So we're not asking you to stop it.
No.
We just want a suspension till we have a little bit more information.
Yes.
Because I'm going to repeat this again. I know that you repeat it all the time. I'm going to say it again because I need people to understand this vaccine does nothing for children. Children do not get sick from COVID unless they have a comorbidity or something else is going on. So young boys in particular are six times more likely to end up in hospital with myocarditis, a problem with the heart, than they are to end up in hospital with COVID.
And which can be a permanent problem.
Yes,
right?
I know. They keep saying things like, oh, well, it's reversible or it gets better. So why would you give something to your child that could even for 10 minutes cause a problem with their heart? Why would you do that?
Why would you?
So why are we doing these vaccines? The whole thing was it was about mental health. Mm. Now, you and I both full well know that the government and Chris Whitty et al. And all these people don't give up buying whatever.
Fortress.
Did you hear? Did you hear what happened? And I don't swear, Mike.
I know you don't.
I'm not a swearer.
I've never heard you swear.
I don't swear, but I'm so close to that. Mm. They did not give a damn about our children's health when they shut down schools.
No.
Britain has the worst record for shutting down schools unnecessarily and needlessly. Even after the reports came out that children are not the super spreaders that they thought they would.
Right.
No more teachers have got COVID than non-teachers have got COVID. It's just all a load of rubbish.
Right.
And they did not give a damn about our children's mental health
during
that time.
And also, nothing has changed since they said that they weren't going to vaccinate children.
No.
Other than their policy, which is now to vaccinate children.
But it's the first time in history that they have gone against the JVCI.
Mm.
It's the first time in history that they've gone against the leading body when it comes to viruses and immunisation. Mm. They've gone against their advice. They advised not to vaccinate children.
Because they said, on balance, it is not worth the risk.
No.
Those were their words, right?
Absolutely.
And so if the risk of getting some kind of damage and harm from a vaccination is worse than the risk of you getting COVID, then where is the logic for then vaccinating the children? There isn't any.
And the other thing that's really sinister, the sinister creep that, you know, our friend Laura Dobbsworth always talks about, is the fact that these people were lined up to go into schools from a long time ago.
Mm.
Their jobs were advertised and they were hired way before the ruling came in that we would vaccinate children.
Right.
Way before any advice was taken.
We're always being told that we've got a shortage of nurses, but apparently we haven't got a shortage of nurses that can go into schools and vaccinate children. But what I haven't heard, and I'm wondering whether this is quite a good thing from our point of view, what I haven't heard is from many parents who have been contacted by the school. You know, letters have been sent out. Mm. Some people have had letters, but I haven't yet heard, and certainly from my own situation, I haven't heard that, that the school is actively kind of encouraging people to get vaccinated. I think they're frightened. I think they're worried because there are a couple of lawsuits going through. And also, if you're running a school, the last thing you need is a child of yours in your care being vaccinated without the permission of their parents and then something going wrong, because that is the end of the school.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? I mean, if you know, I haven't had any letters yet from my son's school, who's 14. I haven't had any information for that. But like many parents I've heard, they would sue not just the school, but they would personally sue the head teacher as well for allowing that to happen.
And I think a lot of them are in
that
situation.
And I would give them funding. If something happened to a child, like has happened to this young girl, Isabella, in Brazil.
And that's in Brazil,
there was a kind of a fund for to sue the school and the head teacher personally, I would be giving my hard-earned cash to that person to sue the hell out of them.
Oh, I'm sure there would be plenty of people willing to crowdfund any kind of lawsuit. Yeah. But the thing is, there is... Richard Tice had a lawyer on, I think it was a couple of Sundays ago, talking about a case that he was bringing on behalf of two girls, two sisters, one 12, one 14, I think, who, interestingly enough, right, are not able to legally be represented because they have to be represented by somebody else because they're not old enough.
Yeah.
But they're old enough to be able to give permission to get a vaccine against their parents' wishes, which is extraordinary. But all he's saying is exactly what Beverly Turner's saying. Can we just pause it, please? Can we just put a hold on it and wait and see until we know a little bit more? Because I think that's fair enough, isn't it?
It really is. And it's this, what's the rush? It's the rush that's so sinister. What is the rush? We know that children are not super spreaders. They're not doing anything. And this whole thing about the vaccine exhausts me. As you know, I'm vaccinated. I did it. I did it through coercion, and I regret
partly
it.
Partly because you had to go away and
see
your parents,
I had to go and see my
right?
parents, and I couldn't. And Cyprus is one of these show your passes places, and I just couldn't. And, I have to go again soon. Yeah. My parents are...
Well, I'm now able to go to America to see my mother, so I'll do the same.
Yeah.
You know, but it doesn't change my view
people
should
here
should be doing at home in London and in Britain, you know, because I will not ever show a vaccine passport here.
Yeah.
I will obviously have to do so to go to America, but my mother's 97. You know, what choice do I have?
Yeah, you have to go and say, you're in the same situation as I am, but I'm disgusted by Britain. I'm disgusted by Boris for pushing through all of this stuff. It's wrong.
Yeah.
It's absolutely wrong. And just to take it back to the kids, you know, they're... Chris Whitty said that he's doing it for children's mental health. I mean, we have...
How does he even know that?
I mean, has Chris Whitty ever sat in a room with a 12-year-old? Do you think he's ever had a conversation with a 12-year-old?
Well, I mean,
does he have any understanding?
He doesn't have any children of his own, which doesn't make him an unlikely sort of person to give advice about children.
Does.
But
it
doesn't help him.
But
it
does, Mike. I'm sorry.
It doesn't help
I will
to
not
do it.
Take advice from anyone about children unless
well,
you've
not
got children.
Well, about your own children.
About any children.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I do feel that you have to have a better understanding of what it's like to live and be, and especially when it comes to competency of a child. It's all very well looking at reports and ticking things, but you have to live with a teenager or an adolescent to understand the way their brain is bonkers, that it's not fully formed. They cannot make these decisions. Mm. They can't sometimes decide what cereal to have in the morning.
Right.
A 12-year-old can't decide. You're fighting with a 12-year-old.
Socks to wear.
Well, you know, you're trying to make sure that they, you know, they snuck in some cornflakes or cereals that are sugary or whatever in the house. We don't have them in our house.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a row that's happened in my house. So one of my sons brought in really sugary cereal and said, I'm having this in the morning. So you're not having that in the morning because it's absolute rubbish and you're not going to have it.
Right.
Now, this is the fight that we're having because they've got no idea what's good for their health. If he had that sugary cereal in the morning, he'll go to school and have a terrible slump, would learn nothing and be miserable.
Yeah.
So I won't let that happen. And yet they're saying that this same child can make a decision about putting a vaccine in their body.
Yeah.
I mean,
and we talked yesterday
insane.
With Laura about the form. I don't know if you've seen this form. Which I haven't actually seen. I've seen it only on Twitter. But this is a form that apparently has been given to the kids in the school where it has a section which is green for if you want the vaccine or red if you don't want it, right? So already they're using colour coding to try and sort of influence.
Subliminal, them. Yes.
And then it says, if you're not taking the vaccine, please tell us why. But then it says, but you don't have to. And you're going, right, so now you want people to tell you why they're not taking it as if to say, oh, well, because my parents are mad anti-vaxxers, or because my parents are crazy, or because my parents are, you know, against medical intervention. I mean, that's kind of the question they're looking to have answered, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is there was a case, and again, it's on Twitter, so it might not be real. There's a guy I follow, Nick the Greek, because obviously he's a Greek, and he was telling us about a situation with his son in the classroom, where his son actually said, look, I'm not going to have the vaccine. I don't think it's the right thing to do. And the teachers in the class kind of turned on him. Mm. And he had to, and he felt very, imagine this is a child of 13, 14, having to make these decisions and have peer pressure. Peer pressure is such a big thing.
Yeah. Oh, it is.
And this has not been taken into account by Chris Whitty. Yeah. So, you know, peer pressure makes kids take drugs, makes them smoke, makes them drink too much, makes them sick, makes them have sex with people they shouldn't be having sex with.
Yeah.
That's what peer pressure does.
Yeah.
So what is it going to do for this vaccine,
exactly,
the way that we've been coerced into
it? And you can't
it?
Always trust teachers to do the right thing, because I've heard stories as well from friends of mine whose kids, for example, weren't wearing a mask in school. And teachers were saying things to them like, why don't you wear a mask? Don't you think COVID exists? You know, as if you're some kind of nutcase and they're trying to wheedle out of you the reason you don't do it is because you've got some kind of bizarre, you know, conspiracy belief about what's going on. And that's wrong. They shouldn't be doing
having
that.
Having been a school teacher, I was a school teacher for 8 years.
Were you?
Yes, I was.
I
changed careers at 32.
Wow.
33, actually.
Okay.
And I worked in Tottenham mainly, actually.
Okay.
Primary schools in Tottenham. Shout out to Lee Valley Primary. And
that's not an easy place to be a teacher, I would imagine.
It's not, but I did a lot of supply teaching in other more privileged places.
Yeah.
And I felt that I was making more of a difference in the less privileged places. And that's...
good for you.
That's what I did. But having say this, I worked with some unbelievably brilliant teachers.
Mm.
And I also worked with some really lousy human beings who it gobsmacked me every day that they were teachers.
Yeah.
So, you know, just because you're a teacher doesn't make you a good person.
No.
And I saw it with my own eyes.
Well, it's like doctors, isn't it? You know,
absolutely.
We've got this sort of obsession with, you know, let's praise all members of the NHS. Well, let's not, actually. I mean, I don't know if you heard Julia's show this morning. She had a guy on at around about just before 8, I think it was, who was talking about the Strictly story, saying, well, of course they should get vaccinated because it's the right thing to do.
Why?
And she's going, well, they can choose not to.
Yeah.
And it turned out that this guy then took the sort of next step and said, well, everybody should be vaccinated. And then admitted that he doesn't mix with people who aren't vaccinated. And she's like, well, do you ask them? And he said, well, yeah. And so there are people now in this country who will not, and we've seen people writing this nonsense, that they won't have a dinner party with anyone who hasn't been vaccinated round to their house.
Wait.
I mean, really?
But can they explain to me why?
No.
Because that's the thing. And then this is the thing that drives me nuts. Wouldn't it be lovely if when I leave today, that you get some callers in, Mike, that explain why it makes a difference.
Mm.
If the vaccines work for you.
Yes.
Why do I have to have it? If the vaccine's
exactly.
working for me,
yeah.
it's working for me. Why do you have
because
to have it?
Because they have a series of arguments, all of which are nonsensical.
Absolutely.
You know? One is, oh, well, it's better for them. And you go, well, why is it better for them? If they're young, as the people on Strictly are, fit, as the people on Strictly are, why is it better for them? Well, because it means if they get COVID, they won't in any way become terribly ill. Right, so...
they never were going to be.
Right, so perhaps they never were. But even if they were... then they say, yes, but it's also safer for the other people. What, the ones who have been vaccinated? Yes. Why? Well, because then they can't pass COVID on. Yes, but you've just told me that if the person's been vaccinated, they're not at any risk of becoming very ill. So they're already protected. So what difference does it make whether they get COVID from the person who's not vaccinated? Because they'll be fine. You can't have it both ways.
And what's happened about natural immunity?
Mm.
You know, if they're so insistent that this thing is, you know, so terrible, not forgetting that the average age of death is still 82.
Still.
It's still 82.
And the
nothing's
two
changed.
Most frequently cited reasons for death are age and weight.
Yes.
Right?
Okay.
Nothing else.
So have you, I'm still waiting to hear about this great scheme that the government are doing, because they, you know, they pour money down the drain on vaccinating children that don't need it.
Yes.
And that all that money, if it went on to cookery classes and health education and showing people how to eat and what not to eat, that's where it would be best spent.
Yes.
Surely that's the right
Absolutely.
Thing to do for
We're
it.
We're also told that there could be as many as 5 million school children who have already had COVID.
That's my point.
One of the questions I think that Beverly Turner's asking is, why not give them all a an antibody test
first.
And if they have the antibodies, they don't need the vaccine, do they?
But we should all have the antibody test.
Yeah.
Because all the studies that are coming through from America and from Israel at the moment are proving that natural immunity could last a lifetime.
Yeah.
Because of the way it affects your cells, it's different to the vaccines, and it can give you immunity, or a much stronger immunity than the vaccines does, for a lifetime.
Right.
And it also prevents the viral load, because they've now showing that people with the vaccine can still carry a massive viral load in their nasal passages and everywhere. So you're more likely to spread it if you've got the vaccine. So none of this is making sense. So why is there a vaccine push? Shall I put my tinfoil hat on?
If you want.
So I'm putting my tinfoil hat on, but it seems to me it's got nothing to do with the virus or to do with a vaccine. It's got to do with the lead up to IDs.
Well, or
digital IDs.
I always revert back to the age-old favourites, follow the money, as they say in
money.
All the President's Men
and
Watergate, because where the money's going is where you're sort of getting the drive from, if you like. And there's an awful lot of people making an awful lot of money. And when you think about the testing companies, you think about the PPE companies, you think about, you know, why do you think suddenly all these companies pivoted to making PPE, or pivoted to selling tests, or pivoted to you know, helping to push the vaccine out? Because there's money to be made. And I think that's probably more likely to be the root of it all.
But then that's what gave me a shiver down my spine. I remember speaking to you last year, and we were talking about the fact that there's somebody that I know who does funding, you know, when you kind of
fund management,
and they were putting a lot of, these are clever people. They're rich because they're clever, and they don't put their money on sure bets.
Yes.
And they have put money into PPE and testing till 2025.
Ah, there we are. Well, here's the other thing, right? If you're going to ask questions about children and whether they should be vaccinated, when the vaccine was formed, they said, this is the answer. This is the way out. Mm-hmm. We will get out of all of this because the vaccine is now here. They now say, actually, the vaccine has got a shelf life, so that if you've had two, you'll need to get a third one. So that tells you they didn't know really how efficacious it was, right? But they're telling us now that they know so much about it that it's safe to give to children.
Absolutely.
I don't believe that.
Absolutely. See, that's the exact point.
Right.
Very well made, Mike. Mm. Exact point. But yet they do know from studies in America and studies in Israel that you, with a strong likelihood that you will have a very long period of being immune if you've had COVID naturally.
Right.
So surely that's what they should be testing for. That's what we should be testing for.
I think
there's some proof that if you've had COVID already and you have the vaccine, you can have some side effects. You know, maybe there might be just small ones initially, but who wants a side effect at all?
It's very rare, isn't it? It's very rare for somebody to catch COVID more than once. It's still pretty rare.
I think they may have found, 2 or 3 cases globally.
Yeah.
And so this kind of, you can catch it again, is again part of the fear mongering. Mm. And all of this, what about long COVID on kids? What about it?
Well, they've now said that that's pretty much a myth.
Yes, it's a lie.
That long COVID is actually a load of, you know, why don't we rename it a load of old cobblers?
I'd love to do that.
You know, I don't believe that long COVID is a thing. You could feel bad for all sorts of reasons.
Yeah.
You could wake up in the morning and just feel a bit bleh, you know, as some people often do, particularly as you get into the winter months and all of that. But that doesn't mean that you're suffering from long COVID just because you had COVID 6 months ago.
No, but Mike, these information that came out yesterday in the Telegraph about how children's mental health has been so seriously affected, that serious mental health issues, including self-harm, suicidal thinking, has leapt up more than 50% since the beginning of COVID.
Mm.
Now, this has got nothing to do with COVID. It's got to do with the response of COVID. So if you have these ridiculously high levels of anxiety in children, then that is going to be the reason that people are feeling so terrible.
Yeah.
It's the anxiety that has been enforced upon us, not COVID.
That upsets your physical health as
well. Absolutely, it really does. And then these statistics now about how many children are on drugs, because, you know, they're not getting to see a doctor. You can't see anyone for love or money. You know the way it is now. Something like 27,000 children a month, largely teenagers, are now prescribed antidepressants, with over 1,000 of those under 11 years old. I mean, and this is just a fob off.
Yeah.
I mean, I literally want to scream like a Greek wailing tragedy as to why they're pouring all this money into vaccinating children instead of pouring money into fixing the children that they broke.
Mm.
They broke these children by lockdowns.
Yeah.
They broke these children by putting in these enforcing things that force them to stay at home, not socialise, not exercise, not live a life. They broke them.
Mm.
put the money into fixing what you broke.
Yeah, very well said. We're out of time, unfortunately. Ugh. I'm going to lead you into. I'm going to take you into a dark room, soundproofed. I knew somebody who used to do primal scream therapy, and you literally go in the room, you just scream, and nobody can hear it.
I feel I need that at the moment.
I think that's what we'll do. Tonya, thank you so much. Tonya Buxton, passionate, absolutely sensible. And what else can we do to convince this government that they're wrong? They're wrong. This is Talk Radio.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
And now, on the front page of The Sun, prickly come dancing, because it looks as though there's a little bit of trouble brewing at the BBC because there are certain people taking part in Strictly who are not vaccinated. There are certain people sort of losing their lunch over this and saying, well, surely everybody should be vaccinated. But why is the question? Let's talk now to Hannah Hope, Assistant Show Business Editor at The Sun on Sunday. Hannah, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning.
So, Strictly, I'm beginning to wonder, first of all, whether Strictly may be getting towards the end of its life, you know, because people have been watching it for so long. I can't stand the show myself, so I'm not a fan. You may well be. But this row has really taken over the news, hasn't it? And it now looks as though they might have an outbreak of COVID as well. So what's going on?
Well, it is an unprecedented situation. Indeed, there is chaos in the ranks backstage at Strictly Come Dancing. So the long and short of it is that three of the professional dancers have refused to have the jab, which isn't against the law. You know, it's up to the individual whether or not they want to have a COVID jab.
Right.
But as we know with Strictly Come Dancing, with the long training sessions, the pros get very up close and personal with the celebrities. You only have to look at the cursor Strictly and the amount of pros who've actually hooked up with their celebrity partners to see that. So understandably, some of the celebrities who are jabbed have said, hang on a minute, I'm going to be dancing up close and personal for 10 hours a day with this pro dancer who has refused to have the jab. And although when you're double jabbed, you're not, you know, you can still get coronavirus, you are less likely to pass it on than someone who isn't jabbed at all. And the BBC really are in a difficult situation because they can't force the dancers to get the jab. But at the same time, if the virus takes over the cast and crew, then there is no show, and it's a live show. It's not pre-recorded. And you say that the ratings were down, which is true. They still had 7.2 million viewers on the Saturday night. It was a pre-recorded show, and I'm sure a lot more people watched it on catch up. And once the live shows start, I expect to see that figure rising to 10 million. Plus, as we always see every year.
Yes, but of course, it's not going to help them very much if they then have to cancel it, because I think this is the first time that, having launched the season, the new season, they're possibly going to have to cancel the whole thing.
I know, it's a very kind of worrying situation. Obviously, there's a lot of money tied up. It's running every Saturday night until Christmas. It's the kingpin of the BBC's entertainment Saturday night schedule. And there is absolute panic. We even had Boris Johnson comment on the situation from America yesterday, urging the dancers to go and get jabbed. So if you've got the PM talking about it, it doesn't get much more serious than that.
Well, no.
We've got former pro dancer James Jordan, who has retired from the show, but he was always very outspoken. He spoke exclusively to The Sun yesterday and was saying that it's disgusting that these dancers haven't got the jab and they shouldn't have been given a job on Strictly if that was the case. Now, it does beg the question that potentially in this situation, should the show have set up a protocol kind of saying, look, we can't force you to get the jab, but in this situation, because so much rides on there not being a Strictly outbreak, you know, maybe you should have only signed up if you're prepared to have the jab. Mm. But I know that a lot of people are against that. And like we've already said, it's not against the law. It's not law to have the jab.
No.
We're getting lots of
but that's the other
there.
Thing, because so, yeah. You've now got the BBC being forced into a situation where they might have to, if they were to do what James Jordan wanted, where they might have to make it more or less a forced jab situation where we've seen other companies doing that, but the BBC doesn't have that policy, because you might equally say, if you were one of the people, and James Jordan saying, we don't know who these three dancers are, he calls them selfish, he says they should be named and kicked off the show, which seems a bit unfair. But if you were one of those people who didn't have it, you'd say, well, all right, I'll tell you what, if you want me to get the jab, what about all the crew? What about everybody that's working on the show? What about everybody that comes into the audience? You know, you start to get to the point where you could make all sorts of demands.
Well, I see your point, but actually, I mean, when you look at the Strictly dances, I mean, look at the tango. It's body to body. You're absolutely breathing in the same air. Mm. That's different than a director or an audience member who's sitting 50 feet away from you. And I've been into the Strictly studio. It's smaller than it looks on TV, but it's not that small. So I do think that it's, you know, I think that it's possible for the audience not to get jabbed, the crew, but you are really dancing really close together, the celebrity and the pro. So, you know, if you were an older celebrity, for example, say you were Greg Wise, who's in his 50s, I don't know, this is just an example, and you'd had the jab, you know, his wife is also in her 60s, Emma Thompson, and then you're partnered with someone who does, who hasn't got the jab, you don't then want to put your family at risk.
Well, you're putting your family at risk by letting them go into the show, as you pointed out earlier, because he might end up waltzing off with whichever the dancer is that he's been set up with. Never mind COVID, you know, it's cheerio, Emma, I'm moving in with this new woman.
Absolutely. I just want to hasten to add, that was just an example. We don't know which dancers have decided not to have the jab. And the BBC, because it's medical, they're saying they can't comment. And that's actually another situation that the BBC have found themselves in. Because it's a whole medical furor, they can't really enforce anything. They can't really comment to the press. It is a real sticky situation.
Do you know, for example, Hannah, whether people who apply to be on Strictly have to have some kind of medical to prove that they're physically fit for insurance purposes? Do they have to have that?
Yeah, absolutely. They do go through a medical, but nothing, you know, you don't know what can happen on the dance floor. I mean, you don't know when a heart attack can strike anyone at any time, at any age.
Yeah.
And as we've seen with COVID, it's a very tricky virus, and you just don't know who or how it's going to affect them. So it is a really difficult situation, and it's one that Strictly bosses are struggling to navigate. I'm sure they're going to try and do it because they've signed up for the show.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't be surprised if we get another. Last year we had Katya Jones, for example, a pro dancer who was diagnosed with COVID, which meant her and Nicola Adams, her celebrity partner.
Oh yes, I remember that. Yeah.
Had to pull out, which was a shame because they were the first same-sex couple. Right. We were excited to see how they progressed. I wouldn't be surprised if we do see that. We already know that one of the celebrity dancers is isolating because they've been diagnosed with COVID.
Right.
We don't know if they've been vaccinated or not. So I do think it's going to be likely that we see celebrity couples pull out because of this situation again.
And how do but they it, work? How do they work the filming sort of sequences? Because I know that obviously they've got live shows from this point on, by and large, on Saturday night, but they do film little segments of people training and stuff, don't they?
Absolutely. So all the pro dancers have been in a training camp, a bubble, if you will. So they go away for several weeks and learn the dances and actually film them in advance. So that's all out the way, which means that when they're, what we see on the Saturday night, which is the couples perform, that's the only live element of the show. That's what's in question at the moment.
Right. So, I mean, are the BBC likely to be coming out with any sort of statement? I mean, are they under serious pressure to get rid of these three?
I think that they are going to do all they can to try and keep them. But I think that they are going to have to cough up a bit more than what they've said so far in terms of the coronavirus protocol, in terms of testing. I think they really will have to explain a bit more because it's got everyone talking and they haven't really resolved it at the moment.
No. Well, this is it. I mean, it's a fascinating story and it's a great story for you guys because obviously, you know, it's the biggest show around at the moment and it's in absolute and utter chaos.
Absolutely. And I'm sure it's going to affect future TV shows going forward. Other big TV shows will be looking at this thinking, right, this has been an absolute disaster. How do we avoid it? And what do we do? So I'm a celebrity, for example. They didn't, I mean, we didn't have the vaccination back in November last year anyway, but they dealt with it quite well in that they got all of the celebrities to isolate before going in. And then once they're in the castle, not the jungle this year, they are kind of isolated anyway. So it worked. But we will see the same sort of situation, I'm sure, with Dancing on Ice, which is an ITV next year.
Right. And I mean, I don't think anybody's going back to Australia anytime soon. So I guess no celeb's going to be in that castle for a while.
Sadly not. But the ratings were actually up last year. Because it was quite fun watching them suffer in a cold castle in Wales rather than living it up in Australia last year. So, yeah, it's good.
Absolutely right. Hannah, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Hannah Hope, their assistant showbiz editor at The Sun on Sunday. I mean, this is the problem that we're going to get with people being, as Tonya Buxton was saying, riddled with fear. You know, people who are frightened of going out, people who only want to mix with other people who have been vaccinated, people who don't want to see people who are not vaccinated. The case here in the BBC Strictly show is that three of the dancers are not vaccinated. Now, and under normal circumstances, that would be fine. If you're vaccinated, why are you worried about somebody who's not vaccinated? That's what Tonya was saying, and she's absolutely right. But if you're in a work situation, are you being told that you have to have a vaccination? I know that certainly there are some organisations around the world, and certainly some in America, who are insisting on people being vaccinated before they come to work. I'm not even sure that that's a legal thing that you can require from people.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.